Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome to the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Now, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, a lot going on. Yesterday, Dennis Kucinich introduced 35 articles of impeachment against George W. Bush on the floor of the House of Representatives. Didn't have quite the weight it would have had it come out of the House Judiciary Committee. In fact, that's really the way it has to go, unfortunately. And didn't have quite the weight it would have had he had, say, 30 or 40 or 50 members of the House standing with him, unfortunately. But I think we need to acknowledge and salute his efforts, particularly given the outcome, the revelations, frankly, of the Senate Intelligence Committee from last Friday, that the Bush administration lied us into this war in Iraq and the ongoing occupation, that they've been lying to us all along, that they knew that they were lying to us from the very beginning. And kudos to the two Republicans on the Intelligence Committee, Olympia Snow and Chuck Hagel, who said, yes, release this information unredacted. They fought the other Republicans there and succeeded. So anyhow, number one. And number two, just a quick heads up, wanted to let you know, Crude Impact, great movie on the nature and problems associated with oil and an oil economy. And, you know, the world based on oil is playing on the Sundance Channel today at 9:35 Eastern Time, 9:35 on June the 10th. On Friday the 13th, it'll be at 10:35 in the morning and at 3:35 in the afternoon, all these Eastern times. The movie is called Crude Impact. I'm in it. But even if I wasn't, I'd recommend it. It's a great movie. I strongly suggest that you TiVo it or DVR it or check or watch it or whatever on the Sundance Channel, that movie. Speaking of oil and speaking of energy policy, both Barack Obama and John McCain are calling for cap-and-trade programs. A cap-and-trade program is where the government says, okay, let's say that there's 100 million tons of carbon being thrown into the atmosphere right now, or let's say, you know, 100 tons of carbon being thrown into the atmosphere right now. We're going to cut that down to 90. You can only 90 are allowable, so we're going to give permits for 90, and people can trade and sell those permits, and so there's an economic incentive. There is a difference between the two plans. Carrie Lucas is with us. She's the Vice President of Economics and Policy at the Independent Women's Forum, IWF.org, the website. And Carrie, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on.
Great to have you here with us. My sense of this is that two things. Number one, that the main difference between the Obama cap-and-trade plan and the McCain cap-and-trade plan is that Obama wants to auction off all of the credits. In other words, they have to be paid for from the get-go, and McCain wants to essentially give them away, which is the mistake that the Europeans made. And my second guess is that you're opposed to either one of them.
Yeah, you know, I'm not really focused on the difference. I don't, you know, I don't know that I'm not happy about the idea of the government using this as a big revenue raiser just to expand government, which I'm sure an auction would help do. But I'm more concerned about the entire concept of adopting a policies that will really be really very extreme economic impact and for very little environmental benefit. Even if you buy into the entire human-caused global warming case, if you accept this as fact, this bill would do have almost negligible impact on the environment and on that warming, and yet it would cost lots of jobs, increase the cost of energy for all of us, increase the cost of goods across the board. So it would really make us a lot poorer.
You know, let me disagree on all points, Carrie. Yes. First of all, neither the McCain nor the Obama camps, neither the official Republican or Democratic Party positions agree with you on that. Secondly, I do agree that there is a problem with this cap and trade. I mean, basically, the bottom line, the question that we have is, are we going to have cap and trade, or are we going to have loot and pollute? Right. I mean, you know, is it going to be unlimited profits for the oil companies and massive amounts of carbon dioxide being dumped into the atmosphere at the time when the world's top scientists are telling us this could destroy future generations? I mean, literally kill off humans. Or are we going to do something? And cap and trade is at least a market and government partnership, as it were. The problem with cap and trade in Europe is that because they didn't combine tariffs with it, and I don't see this in either Obama or McCain's programs, and therefore I'm concerned about both of them, because they didn't include a tariff in there that said, okay, if you want to get around cap and trade and you go to Morocco, for example, which is where most of the European countries are going for their manufacturing, Morocco is kind of for carbon production has become like China is for us for factory floor stuff. If you go to Morocco and you produce the most carbon-intensive part of your product and then just import it back into Europe, there's no import tariff that would represent what that carbon tax would be, essentially, in cap and trade. And I think that we need to have that here, and the Europeans are seriously looking at that, at the deficiencies of their own program. Your thoughts on the difference between cap and trade and loot and pollute, and how to make cap and trade better if we're stuck with it?
You know, I think that we need to be, what people need to do is they need to start getting educated on the costs and benefits of all of these proposals, because I think that there's a lot of folks out there who like the idea of being pro-environment and just accept this idea of alarmism about global warming. And I know that
By a lot of folks, you mean a majority of the world scientists.
It's interesting because I know that you're going to just paint me as a wacko for doing anything that would say we need to take a little bit of caution when it comes to the science. But you know, there's a really interesting book out there that I would encourage everybody to take a look at, and it's a guy who's a journalist, and he went through, and it's called The Deniers, because so much of the media and so many people have tried to paint anybody who questions the idea, the Al Gore version of global warming, have painted them as crazy flat earthers, and it goes through and it looks at how some of the top scientists in the world have been questioning aspects of the global warming case. There's so much climate is incredibly complicated when we're looking back over the course of millions and millions of years of the Earth's history. You know, the relationship between how much carbon is in the air and our temperature is not as clear-cut as Al Gore would like to make it be.
But the one thing we know is that when we passed the 350 parts per million threshold, and we're pushing 385 parts per million now, and we were on the 200, in the mid-200 range just 150 years ago, when we passed that threshold, we hit a level of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere that this planet has not seen in over 600,000 years before the emergence of the human race.
Well, I think that people need to go out there and read a whole bunch of different analysis of the science out there, because one thing I think we just need to be a little bit skeptical and cautious about all this and to realize.
Let's be skeptical and cautious about the oil industry pumping more and more carbon dioxide, this huge experiment that's being done on the atmosphere of the entire planet. You know, Carrie, the entire height of the atmosphere is only about 5 miles. You know, you and I could walk that in a little more than an hour, the distance from Earth, from where we're standing to the top of the troposphere, you know, the majority of the atmosphere that we use and breathe, that little it's only 5 miles, that little thin band of air around our planet is being, you know, basically dumped into. I mean, you know, we're pouring all these pollutants into it. That's the experiment that we should be skeptical of.
Okay, well then Tom, then why aren't you out there saying, okay, we need to just outlaw carbon emissions? Let's go ahead.
I think we need to tax carbon. I think that we should do what Sweden did and say, you want to emit carbon $300 a ton, no problem.
Okay, and And then so, but I think that all your listeners should out there, this sounds great, and okay, yeah, let's go and do this. But realize that you are going to be assigning people, particularly in the developing world, to absolute abject poverty.
People in the developing world produce very little carbon, Carrie.
And they won't for as long as we, if we want to just trap them in the world.
No, they will be at the forefront of non-carbon technologies, and there's a whole bunch of them out there. It's called solar, it's called wind, it's called biomass, it's called the geothermal.
That we're ready to go fully to solar. Then, you know, I think if you hear,
we could go, listen, if we can, in 6 months, if we can convert every car manufacturing factory in the United States to manufacturing tanks, as Franklin Roosevelt did in 1943, if we can do that, we can go solar.
Okay, well then, and then you're going to have, right now you've seen that what.
And look at how many people went to work as a result of that, by the way.
If you right now want to see what happened to world food prices have been climbing and causing starvation in places like Africa, in part because of our push to use corn for ethanol, and so corn is no longer.
That's
available.
Only 3%. 3% of total corn usage in the United States is for ethanol, and it's not significantly affected. Although I agree with you, corn is the worst. We should be growing hemp, and we should be making biodiesel instead of corn. But nonetheless, that's not the biggest factor.
The biggest factor
is the collapse of the dollar and.
The groups that you believe for global warming, like the UN, you take all the scientists for them for fact. I know that they've blamed a lot of what's been going on in terms of rising food prices
on our
energy policies and on this increasing use of biofuels. This is a real effect, and it's going to only get worse if we head down this road.
Okay, you had the last word. Carrie, thanks a lot for dropping by.
Thank you.
Carrie Lewis, the Vice President of Economics and Policy at the Independent Women's Forum, IWF.org, if you want to read all about it. Carrie, thanks a lot for being
here. Thank you.
16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
The hour as we work out the bugs here. Speaking of working out the bugs, you know, it's amazing. This is not something new. I mean, this is not a brand new problem. This is a problem that we've known about for a long time. And once again, we can track this back to Ronald Reagan. I mean, Ronald Reagan, the Calvin Coolidge. Well, worse than that, the Herbert Hoover of this generation. It's just Jimmy Carter saw this coming. Frankly, Richard Nixon saw this coming and tried to do something about it. Richard Nixon was the guy who actually, I guess, maybe it was during the Carter administration, but Nixon had originally proposed as part of it, I guess it was, this was the remnant, the windfall profits tax, and it was the profit, singular. And where is that? Somebody's got a mic open here, a speaker. Anyhow, I'm sorry, I'm being distracted. Here's Jimmy Carter talking about this. And maybe it's not.
Worldwide, it is a clear and present. The energy crisis is real. It is worldwide. It is a clear and present danger to our nation. These are facts, and we simply must face them. What I have to say to you now about energy is simple and vitally important. Point one, I am tonight setting a clear goal for the energy policy of the United States. Beginning this moment, this nation will never use more foreign oil than we did in 1977. Never.
And we were actually on track to do that. And right now, had Carter's policy stayed in place, we would not be using more foreign oil than we were in 1977, which was a relatively small amount. And it's not because we'd be pumping more oil domestically, but because he was encouraging conservation and solar power, and there were tax credits for solar. He put solar panels on the White House. He lowered speed limits around the country. Just a whole straightforward, this was not rocket science. This didn't require the Manhattan Project. It was easy stuff to figure out, and Carter put it into place, and it worked. And then Reagan comes into office as a result of the early days of the Iran-Contra thing, we'll sell you weapons if you'll keep those hostages until the election. The Iranians did. They released the hostages the moment that Reagan was being sworn into office. And as a result of that, those last 6 weeks with the hostages being held, Jimmy Carter was a relatively popular president, actually, at the time. I know that the Republicans have tried to reinvent history, but those of you old enough to remember that, in fact, Reagan was, 8-10 points down in the polls just a few months out because everybody considered him a right-wing crackpot, which it turns out he was. But as the hostages dragged on and on and on, Carter's ratings went down and down and on. Reagan comes in and takes down the solar panels off the roof of the White House, turns the thermostat back up in the White House, turns back on the fireplace in the summer and turns on the air conditioning, the whole thing, right down the board. And Jimmy Carter, in fact, actually, he went on to say about the solar.
Moreover, I will soon submit legislation to Congress calling for the creation of this nation's first solar bank, which will help us achieve the crucial goal of 20% of our energy coming from solar power by the year 2000.
By the year 2000. Regular listeners of the program have heard this clip before. I think it's so important that we remember that loot and pollute, the Bush policy of loot and pollute, rather as opposed to cap and trade or doing anything about carbon and carbon destroying our atmosphere, that this is not new. This is the Reagan policy. And the McCain policy, to a large extent, their cap and trade, here's the difference. Cap and trade is where you say, okay, we're going to allow only a certain level of pollution and beyond our carbon dioxide emission in this case, which is a pollutant, we're going to allow only a certain amount of that. Beyond that, you can't do it, okay? And we're going to issue, and there'll be huge penalties and fines. We're going to issue permits for this. Now, what the Europeans did is they gave away or very cheaply sold the permits. What Barack Obama, the difference between Obama's plan and McCain's plan with regard to cap and trade is that Obama is saying 100% of these permits need to be auctioned off right from the get-go. So right from day one, companies that are producers of carbon, companies that are heavy polluters, and I know you're going to hear a lot of squealing from the fossil fuel industry and companies associated with them and people associated with them and think tanks funded by them, et cetera. Right from day one, carbon producing industries are going to have to, they're going to have to start making changes. And what's that going to do? It's going to drive innovation. It's going to drive the American spirit. I mean, we can take on challenges in this country. We can take on the challenge of climate change. We can do that all around the world. But I strongly believe that we have to, number one, tie it to a tariff of some sort so that we say if your company has, say you've got a company that's making something that has a lot of carbon in it or that uses a lot of carbon in the production. So they say, okay, that part of the product, we're going to just start making that in China. China's not participating in cap and trade. So they end up not having to pay for it. So what we need to do is have tariffs that say the equivalent of the carbon content from something imported, we're going to charge a tax on that. Without a tariff, then you're going to see what happened in Europe, and that is that a lot of companies are simply going to go offshore for their polluting part of their industries. So we need to fine-tune this, but nonetheless, the 100% auction that Obama is proposing is a great start, and we've got to start if we want to hand this planet off to our children in a reasonable fashion at all.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
We're the ones who need it worst. Let the rest of the world help us for change, and let's rebuild America first.
You tell them, Earl.
Our highways and bridges are falling apart. Who's There's things to be done all over the world, but let's rebuild America.
And let's start out by rebuilding and reinventing, essentially, our energy infrastructure. Do we want to have cap and trade or loot and pollute? That ultimately is going to be the bottom line here. And, well, so far it's been loot and pollute. They've been winning ever since Ronald Reagan took over the presidency. And we really, really, really need to be moving along. By the way, I just want to mention one other thought on Dennis Kucinich's impeachment resolution. The only reason why I may oppose impeachment, and I'm not opposed to it, but if one were to make an argument against it, the argument against it would be that it's too soft a remedy. George Bush and members of his administration who lied us into this war in Iraq, as the Senate Intelligence Committee has documented, need not to be impeached. They need to be prosecuted. Not just prosecuted out of office. Vince Bugliosi, who is suggesting that prosecutors all over the United States from districts and areas where people have died in Iraq, let's prosecute them. I think he's got it. I think he's spot on. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Vince was on this show a couple of weeks ago. Jeff in Denver. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
Carrie, your guest, I believe that was her name.
Carrie Lucas.
Yeah, she had 180-degree backwards on some things. And I'd like to give six quick examples how alternative energy is freeing people.
Sure.
And around the world right now, indigenous people are being enslaved and their lives are being denigrated by petroleum drilling and so forth, such as in the Niger Delta and rainforest in Peru. And non-petroleum energies are freeing people. If you look in Greece, most houses in Greece have solar hot water.
Same in Israel, by the way.
Yeah, and I mean, it's cheaper, and it's happening. I mean, these are poorer countries. It's happening all over. Solar energy in Morocco, they're bringing it to villages where it's more expensive than bringing power lines in. Mm. Their water pumps.
You mean it's less expensive than bringing power lines in?
Excuse me?
You mean bringing in solar is less expensive than bringing in power lines?
Yeah, excuse me. Yeah, sorry. Back other backwards. They have water pumps in Africa that are playground merry-go-rounds. So children playing pump the village water. Water turbines in Nepal are providing lights for LEDs at night so villagers can read.
Yeah.
And you were just in Darfur.
Yeah.
And right now, you know, desertification there is caused a lot by the cooking fires where people.
Yeah.
You know, and also women get raped when they go out to gather wood.
Yeah.
And solar stoves in the Sahara can really prevent that. Solar stoves cost 10, 15 bucks or even
less.
That's right. And another place where petroleum is actually causing problems here, where we had an alternative technology, it worked beautifully, is in Bahrain, where they have the wind towers that air condition the houses. And you could have, you know, 50-degree air coming into a house, cooling off the house dramatically on a warm day. But now people are buying air conditioners. Well, they already have these wind towers, which were just, you know, very inexpensive thing to build.
Right. Because in Bahrain, oil is cheap.
Yeah. And so it's like there are alternative technologies all over the place that other countries are using. And they're cheap or they're free. And they work very well, where petroleum is the thing causing the problems.
That's right. And they're decentralized, which is, again, why the big corporations are opposed to them, because they all want to control this. They want to control our water. They want to control our transportation infrastructure. They want to control our energy supplies.
I would like to call decentralized energy generally personal power. And that's the thing where we don't have to keep paying the man the bill every month. It's more secure. I mean, if we had alternative energy and New Orleans with Hurricane Katrina, most people wouldn't have lost their power. They wouldn't have lost all these other things, you know, that gave them freedom. And, like, right now, if we were to build a pipeline from Anwar down to, you know, the ports in southern Alaska, one person could destroy our energy supply with just a rifle.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Jeff, thanks so much for the points you make, and they're well made. Tom in Belle Plaine, Iowa. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, how's it going over there?
Just great, but we'll get better. What's on your mind?
I was just thinking of something kind of way out there, like the year 3000. What you want to do is you want to take a look at geographically of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Take the oldest city from the newest, less the historic ones that are markers.
Right.
And start laying out pipelines, everything in sort of zigzag to keep you awake, straight point.
Right.
Start putting everything straight points, crisscross, all the way across, and then you would have like little little villages or communities where you put your Walmart, you would put your cleaners, your bars for the guys, shopping for the women, and everything would be like Key West or Mackinac Island. Everybody's on a moped. There'd be no cars,
In other words, let's reinvent our country. You know, Greensburg, Kansas is doing this right now, and they're doing it as green as they possibly can. Leo DiCaprio helped them out with a substantial grant, and there's others, you know, who are involved. We're right now in the process, and Tom, I thank you for the call. Excellent point. We're in the process of working out the details. We may be doing our show from there sometime this summer. We'll see how that works out, and you know, we're trying to make it happen. It's not the easiest place to get to, but the point is that cities around the world, frankly, are saying, yeah, let's do something different. Let's absolutely reinvent the world. Susan in Goldendale, is it Goldendale, Washington, Susan?
Yes, it is.
Hey, Susan, welcome to the show.
I listen to you all the time, and I thank you very much for all your information. And what I wanted to say is that lady that you just had on, I know that you don't like negative stuff, but just a little bit.
Here to defend herself, so let's just talk about the issues rather than talking about Carrie.
Okay, well, what she said was, you know, every time that you make a point, she makes a point about money. You know, you can't breathe money, you can't eat money, you can't do any or jobs. You know, it makes no sense. If we keep polluting like we are, then we're not going to be able to breathe or eat. We're not going to have anything to eat. I just saw in the front of the Portland paper that our oysters are dying because of the warm water.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and that's just a tip, just a tiny little thing. So, you know, we can have all the jobs and all this and all of that, but if we can't breathe and we can't eat, what are we going to do?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And the fact of the matter is we're already, and thank you, Susan, for calling and making that point, we're already paying right now, we're paying over $10 a gallon for gasoline. That's what we're paying right now. You're paying $4 at the pump. You're paying $3 to $4 in taxes for the military of the United States, the intelligence services of the United States, to protect the oil infrastructure, to protect ships coming out of the Gulf of Hormuz, the Straits of Hormuz, and out of the Middle East and other parts of the world to bring that oil to the United States. We're paying for that with our general tax dollars through a $500 billion defense bill or annual defense tab. You're paying for that. That's another $4. And then on top of that, there's another $3 or $4 a gallon that we're paying in terms of health costs, the cost of all the cancers that are caused by using carbon fuels, by using gasoline, or petroleum-based fuels, and coal-fired power plants and things like that. We're paying for that in the cost of health care in the United States. We're paying for that in the cost of asthma that our children have. We're paying for that in terms of the mercury that's in our lakes and rivers making our fish uneatable and all these kind of things. So the fact of the matter is we're paying $10 to $12 a gallon right now for gasoline. It's just that most of it's hidden. And it's hidden in taxes that most, you know, average working people are paying. And that's why, you know, for example, Sweden's suggestion, Sweden's thing of saying, okay, we're going to have a carbon tax. And by the way, let's lower income taxes and make it up with a carbon tax. Hey, it's there. It's already happening. Tom in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind?
Good day from the Buckeye State, Tom.
Well, thank you, Tom. And
hey,
greetings back from Portland.
Hey, thanks. Real quick, I'm part of a rural electric company co-op that's nonprofit.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem I have with carbon credits, in a way, for myself and for other people near me that might be on low income or fixed income, is if they do carbon credits, I'm told from the electric company that we're going to go from 8 cents per kilowatt to anywhere between 11 and 12 cents per kilowatt. And if that raise comes with a nonprofit, they'll pass that directly on to the consumer. And my biggest issue is I'm just worried. I'm a conservationist, and I'm, you know, pretty green-type fellow. But what I'm also worried about, too, in the same rights, is if with the carbon credits and with the EPA, and I really think the manipulation of oil and gas in particular, I really think they're trying to move the remaining manufacturing that we have in the United States out to Mexico and India.
Well, that's why I said we need to tie this into a tariff. I've been calling for tariffs from the get-go just based on the cost of labor. Historically, we had tariffs based on labor. A tariff is an import tax where we said, you know, if it costs a dollar to make that pair of shoes here in the United States and you want to make those same shoes for 20 cents in China, that's fine, but we're going to charge you 80 cents when you import them. We need
sure.
to say, okay, we're charging now, let's say that there's a dollar's worth of carbon in a product. And we're going to have you pay for the carbon. Because the fact of the matter is, if the actual cost, including the carbon cost of the electricity that you're using right now, is, say, 11 cents a kilowatt hour, because of the cost of all the hurricanes that are wiping out or tornadoes and things. You know, I mean, we're paying for a lot of this stuff out of our tax dollars. Every time the president declares a disaster or an emergency, that's coming out of your and my taxes. So we're already, and not to mention the asthma and the, you know, everything else and cancers and whatnot. So we're already paying, you're already paying 11 cents. So if what they're saying is we're going to pay 11 cents for the electricity that's generated using carbon, then it seems to me ultimately that that's a good thing because it's going to discourage the carbon and it's going to encourage the use of wind and solar. And if you're feeding back to the utility or if you're selling to your customers, how's it going to hurt?
I just think in general, I don't know if a lot of people will have the money, especially people on fixed income and low income, to do
right.
solar power, wind. Hey, one last.
Well, that's
comment.
Why we need to have tax credits for this kind of thing, as Barack Obama is proposing doing, as Jimmy Carter did.
And
you know, we'll actually give you cash, even if you don't pay income taxes. We'll give you cash to solarize your house, and you know, get off the grid. I mean, we just need to get off our addiction to carbon. Tom, I got to take a break. Thank you very much for the call, though. This is the delicate balancing act, and this is the problem. When you look at the history of so-called free market solutions, it's the market doesn't respond until there's a disaster. And when it responds, it hurts a lot of people in the middle. That's why we need to get out ahead of this thing to the extent that we can.
The Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Grumpy old man straight out of D.C. The Straight Talk Express is shiny and slick, where I built up my rep as a maverick. If you look at the facts, you might see it's a push, because most of the time, hell, I voted with Bush. Well, my friends, it doesn't matter, I don't have to save face, and I have a great chance, because the press is my base.
Ha! Your base! Ha! Ha! Your base! Ha! Your base!
Ha, yeah, ha, the press base. Is his base.
Ha, base.
It's the John McCain rap. Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program and a Higgins alert. You know, my crazy cat Higgins. He, anytime somebody walks into the house, he attacks them. We have an attack cat. What can I say? We have a cat that is intent, in fact, on conquering the world. John Bolton is going to be a guest in our next hour. My cat reminds me more of John Bolton than anybody else I know. Dr. Leslie Lyons is with us. She's a geneticist and spokesperson for the National Geographic Channel Explorer. There's a new series out, and it's called Explorer, The Science of Cats. It's airing tonight at 10 o'clock Eastern Time on the National Geographic Channel. And Dr. Lyons, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much. It's very nice to join you.
Thank you. How did humans and cats form this weird bond?
Yeah, well, I think it behooved both of us. So cats saw an easy, free meal because humans started to settle down to become farmers
mm-hmm.
and stay in one place, build civilizations. And with that came grain stores and refuse piles, which brought in lots of rodents. And so the wild cat really kind of subspeciated, became a new type of cat, the domestic cat, which moved into this new niche that we developed and really became the cats that we see in our household now.
So they adapted themselves to the environment that we created. This is evolution, I suppose, in a way. I mean, we're talking actual genetic changes
Absolutely.
Over time as a result of behavior, as a result of a change in the environment.
Exactly.
This is like Darwin's finches.
Exactly, yes. So you can see changes in behavior, you can see changes in size, and also those coat colors. Just every day you see tabby and white cats and black
right.
cats and blue cats. Those wouldn't exist in the wild.
Oh, interesting. And one last question. How different are all the different breeds of cats? You know, for example, we know that different races of humans are really pretty much, you know, it's such a minor difference that it's the most minor, frankly, of most of our differences. And with cats, with different species of cats, are these major genetic differences or are they similar to racial differences in humans, that is, very minor differences?
A little of both. So there's some over 40 recognized breeds of cats, but we see some breeds we can't separate, like the Siamese is so closely related to Oriental short hairs and color point short hairs, that's like one race.
Right.
Where a Siamese versus a Persian are fairly different, and we can tell them genetically apart.
Right. Fascinating. Dr. Leslie Lyons, thanks so much for dropping by today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Great talking with you. Fascinating stuff. Fascinating stuff. The National Geographic special tonight. 866-303-2270, your telephone number. Marcia in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Marcia.
Hi, can you hear me?
I can. Can you hear me?
Yes,
is this a bad cell phone commercial?
Now, can I ask you something? Please
sure.
Don't cut me off, because this is probably the most important call. Now, we were offered a chance to use these pills in our gasoline so that we would get 17% more gas mileage.
Right.
And I was scared. So I called the Wichita, I guess, vehicle place. And there's
right.
someone who is in charge of all the city
right.
vehicles.
Right.
And these pills are used. Now, they have this old truck that shouldn't have even been on the road, and they put the pill in, and
right.
and the truck didn't
Marcia,
have...
Marcia, let me tell you, if there was any product out there that would increase your gas mileage by 17% and not hurt your car, it would be...
Let me tell you something.
No, I'm sorry. I'm not... I don't believe it. I'll just say right up front. I've seen these things come and go 1,000 times in the last 30 years, and if any of them worked, they would be widespread. It would be out there. Ain't gonna happen. Paul, and thank you for the call. Paul in Jupiter, Florida. Hey, Paul.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I was calling about the woman that was talking earlier, and as far as I'm concerned, the planet was able to thrive because all that carbon was in the ground. Now they're taking it and throwing it in the air, and they don't think anything's going to happen.
Right. Well, actually, the planet was thriving back when there was enormous amounts of carbon in the atmosphere, but it was a different type of life that was thriving than the type that we have right now. And so, you know, if the temperature of the planet was a whole lot warmer, and the climate was different, and the land masses were, everything was different. This was before humans came around. The question that Jim Hansen points out in his 2006 article in Science magazine, and he's repeating in the one that he just submitted, is that now that we've crossed the 285 parts per million threshold of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, we're back to an atmosphere that looks like the atmosphere did 600,000 years ago. There was no human life on the planet 600,000 years ago. The primates that preceded us were confined to a very small part of South Central Africa 600,000 years ago, and they lived in a very, very, you know, in a microclimate, basically. Yeah, is that what we're going to end up with? Are we going to end up with a planet where only 10% of it is habitable for humans?
Why would they want to take a risk like that for some profit?
Because Rex Tillerson can make $400 million.
Yeah, I just don't understand where money became more important to life. When did that happen on this planet?
I 7,000 years ago in Sumeria. That's the foundation of our civilization. Our modern civilization is the idea that the rich can conquer the poor, and that hierarchy and kingdom are better than cooperation and egalitarianism. And there have been a lot of times that we've pushed back on that.
Yeah.
From the founding of this country. I mean, you know, that we were a very progressive country the first 30 years or so of our existence, and then we slid back into greed. And then we became we had a progressive revolution with Teddy Roosevelt in 1900, and then in 1908 we slid back into greed. That drove us right into the Great Depression. The economic policies that the Republicans were pursuing from 1907 to 1929 were identical, virtually. I mean, huge tax cuts for the wealthy, stopped enforcing the Sherman antitrust law. All these big giant monopolies came out. The dynastic families rose up. You saw the rise of the Rockefellers and the Mellon and this, you know, all this stuff. And then we went back to being a progressive nation from the time of Franklin Roosevelt in the 30s until Ronald Reagan was elected in the 1980s. And then we became a conservative nation again, and we went nuts again. And here we are, right at the edge of 1929 all over again. Stick around. We're going to talk about Iran next.
Tom Hartman.
Taking back the mainstream media.
3 hours a day, 5 days a week.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
The true people's radio.
Tom Hartman.
Now, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back. The price of oil is being factored into the price of oil right now. The probability or the possibility that the United States or Israel or both are going to strike Iran's nuclear facilities? And if so, how will Iran respond? In about 15 minutes, we're going to be asking John Bolton his thoughts on that. First, I wanted to get Robert Naiman in here. Robert Naiman is a senior policy analyst and national coordinator at justforeignpolicy.org. He's the editor of the daily news summary there. He blogs over at the Huffington Post, justforeignpolicy.org. Robert, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
I appreciate your coming on. What is the case to be made for and against? Let me preface this. Last Thursday, I did the show. We did the show live from the United Nations, and I had on the official spokesperson for the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Administration, or agency, and she said that Iran is now out of compliance with the IAEA, and they are in defiance of several United Nations resolutions having to do with the enrichment of uranium. And she said that there's no evidence that they're enriching beyond the 3% level for nuclear power up to the 95% I guess level necessary to make a bomb, but there's no evidence that they're not, and that's how they're out of compliance. How should the world respond to this? And what what happens if there is a response not unlike what Israel did in Syria just a few months ago when they took out the reactor in Syria, or as they did back in the 80s when they took out the reactor in Iraq, in both cases with virtually no blowback at all?
Well, first of all, let's speak about the thing that should be ruled out. It's absolutely true that Iran is not complying with UN Security Council resolutions, right, that called on it to suspend its enrichment of uranium. Of course, under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, Iran has the right to enrich uranium. So when we speak about the Security Council resolutions, we're speaking about something that's beyond Iran's obligation under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Right. So in other words, from their point of view, they signed a treaty that said that they would comply in a particular way and they can have nuclear power. The Security Council said, no, you can't have nuclear power, even though you did sign this thing. And they're saying, we're not recognizing your authority. Essentially, is that it?
Yeah. I mean, the Security Council didn't say you can't have nuclear power. The Security Council said,
you can't enrich your own uranium.
You can enrich uranium. And the reason you can't enrich uranium is that we demand this because we don't trust you.
Right.
And in order for negotiations to start, you have to first suspend the enrichment of uranium.
Right.
However, the Iranians believe, I think with considerable evidence, if you sort of follow the news on this, that the objective of the United States is not a temporary suspension of their enrichment of uranium, but a permanent suspension of their enrichment of uranium. And in Iran society, this is a non-starter. This is a red line. People perceive the enrichment of uranium to be a matter of, you know, national pride, technological process. Look, here again, the imperialists are trying to keep Iran from technically...
Well, there's also enormous profit. I mean, if they're forced to buy enriched uranium from the first world, I mean, France is one of the world's leading suppliers of enriched uranium, for example, and they're on the Security Council. The United States is a supplier of enriched uranium. Russia is a supplier of enriched uranium. There's a lot of Security Council members who suddenly will stand to make a big profit if Iran has to buy their enriched uranium from them rather than enriching it themselves.
That's true, although I think the main point is the one that I stressed. That
national pride.
That it's not financial. It has to do with, perception of role in the world.
So how do we respond to them, and what happens if we respond to them brutally, violently?
Yeah, so the first thing is if the United States were now to attack Iran under the justification of we have to prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons, that would be a war crime. That would be a violation of international law. It would not be self-defense against armed attack. and it would not be authorized by the UN Security Council. Therefore, it would be a war crime. So it would be certainly a strange justification to say, because Iran has not complied with the UN Security Council resolution saying that it has to suspend enrichment of uranium, therefore the United States is going to bomb Iran, right, creating a much greater crime, international law, than the crime that the Iranians have committed of non-compliance.
Right.
Now, the second thing is, it should be pointed out that there is an offer on the table. The Iranians have indicated, most recently in an interview with Iran's UN ambassador in the Boston Globe just a week or so ago, that they would consider a proposal for an international consortium to enrich uranium on Iranian soil, an international consortium with Iranian participation of other countries that would enrich uranium in Iran. What's significant about this is that, at least in broad outline, the same proposal has been proposed by independent experts, including former U.S. Ambassador Thomas Pickering, who's the Reagan administration's ambassador to El Salvador and Israel in the 1980s. He's now the co-chair of the International Crisis Group. This is not, you know, some academic in New Hampshire. This is somebody who's a member of the United States foreign policy establishment. So there's a proposal on the table that's been made by Iran that could quite possibly solve this problem, to the extent that, you know, the United States is concerned that Iran is actually, although now they're just enriching uranium, according to the U.S. National Intelligence Estimate, they may be developing capacity in the future that would enable them to develop nuclear weapons. There's a proposal on the table that would that could meet U.S. objections and also meet Iranian interests in having uranium enrichment on their soil.
Right. Let's assume for a moment.
Why are we talking about that?
Right. And we should be talking about that, and that seems like a really important thing. But let's assume for a moment, just as Saddam Hussein was saying, hey, no problem, come on in, look over my country. Mohammed al-Baradei, Hans Blix, anybody, you're welcome. I got nothing. Here, come on and look. And we bombed him anyway. What if George Bush really believes all this neocon stuff and says, okay, that's it, we're gonna bomb them, we have to do that? Or if Israel does and we support them, what will be the consequence? It seems to me that the average Iranian, most of the opinion polls I've seen indicate that the average person on the street is very pro-American. That is going to change in a heartbeat. Plus, we've got 300,000 people in a principally Shiite country in Iraq between the contractors and the soldiers who are, it seems to me, would become suddenly hostages. I mean, doesn't this have the potential to explode in a way that is mind-boggling?
Yes, and not only do I believe that, but apparently the U.S. Pentagon believes it, the Defense Department believes it, because one of the main obstacles, internal obstacles to a U.S. military attack in Iran, is what you just described. People in the Pentagon are afraid that Iran has very available means to retaliate against the United States because of its influence
in Iraq. Yeah. So, in other words, their primary retaliation would simply be encouraging the Shia mullahs in Iraq to declare that the U.S. occupiers should be harmed in some way.
Well, indeed, it's already the case that, in fact, Iran is kind of a restraining force in Iraq. You have a broad spectrum of opinion in Iraq, including people with guns, who want to drive the U.S. out, or are very concerned that the agenda of the U.S. is to establish permanent bases and permanent control in the country. And so all you would need is for the Iranians to stop.
Right. This could be the spark that could blow the whole thing up. Yeah, I get it. We're talking with Robert Naiman, justforeignpolicy.org. Robert, we have just a half a minute left. It seems that the bottom line is our best option is to pursue this joint group enriching in Iran. That seems to be the solution. Is there any movement in that direction in the Security Council?
Well, I think the overarching point is that the United States should pursue diplomacy with Iran without preconditions. Right now, the position of the United States is we're not even going to talk to them unless they suspend the enrichment of uranium, which is essentially saying that we're not going to talk to them.
Right. So we need Barack Obama as president right now, not in 224 days.
If they would agree, I would agree.
There you go. Robert Naiman, justforeignpolicy.org, the website. Robert, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Coming up next, former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton, on the same topic. And by the way, if you want to drop by airamerica.com/TomVision, T-H-O-M Vision, you can see our webcast today.
Tom Hartman.
Helping you win the water cooler wars.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Past the hour. Always helps when you turn your mic back on. And it's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton, is with us. Ambassador Bolton, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
And pardon me for we're just now going to a video stream, and we're figuring out the audio end of it, so things are running a little weird at times. You're on the record. You told the Telegraph back on May 6th and essentially said the same thing on this show around that time, that you favor striking the nuclear facilities in Iran. I'm wondering if Thomas Pickering, Reagan's ambassador, former ambassador to Israel's support and others within the Pentagon's support of this international group enriching uranium in Iran that Iran has said that they will agree to do, has changed your mind on whether or not it's a good idea for the United States to attack Iran's nuclear facilities?
Well, I think what I have said every time I've discussed that possibility is that I think that the use of military force against Iran's nuclear program is a very unattractive option and to be used as a last resort. But when you consider the other alternative of an Iran with nuclear weapons, then I think it has to be on the table. But I've never had any doubt that it was risky and something that I wish we could avoid. I'm just afraid that 5 years of failed effort at negotiation has left us with very few other alternatives unless we're prepared to see Iran with nuclear weapons.
So you think we're actually very close to the point where if we don't strike them militarily, that they will be enriching uranium up to that 90-some-odd percent threshold and producing nuclear weapons?
Well, they've already demonstrated they can enrich up to reactor-grade level. There's no doubt
about
it.
That's only 3%, though.
Yes, but that is, as any nuclear physicist will tell you, that is 70% of the work needed to get to weapons-grade enrichment, which is 90% enriched uranium. So they've already gone more
than... Well, it's 70% of the work in as much as it's building the centrifuges.
They use the same centrifuges
right.
They use to enrich to 3 to 5%. So they've already got the capability. They've already demonstrated they can make that capability work, and they've demonstrated they have control over the entire nuclear fuel cycle, all the way from uranium in the ground to getting the highly enriched uranium that they need for nuclear weapons. So they have very, very few other steps they need to take, and that leads me to the conclusion that they are very close, and that therefore further negotiation is only going to do what it's already done for the last 5 years, which is give them additional time that they need to finish those final steps.
So then you favor striking them now?
No, I don't necessarily favor striking them now. I think this is a very difficult question. My own preference would be to change the regime in Tehran. I think it's a very weak and unpopular regime, and I think if we had been working on that with Iranian exiles and with dissidents inside Iran over the last 5 years, we'd be in a very different place than we are now.
Well, we have been funding those efforts, and also, wouldn't striking Iran's nuclear facilities solidify? I mean, the regime, my understanding is the majority of the average Iranian on the street, the majority of Iranians are actually pro-American. That'll change really fast if we drop bombs on their country.
We have not really been funding the opposition. That's been part of the problem. And let's be clear what we're talking about attacking. This would not be anything like what happened in Iraq. There'd be no ground forces of any size involved. It would be largely attacks on the well-known uranium enrichment facilities at Natanz, the uranium conversion facility at Esfahan, or the heavy water production facility and heavy water reactor at Iraq. And I do think that if we were driven to the point of using military force, it certainly ought to be accompanied by a very vigorous public diplomacy campaign explaining to the Iranian people that this is directed solely at the nuclear weapons program and certainly not at them.
Ambassador Bolton, we have a little less than a minute. If we were to, there's no UN provision allowing us to attack Iran at the moment. This would be a war crime if we were to.
Of course it would. That's ridiculous. Article 51 of the UN Charter states that nothing in the Charter is intended to contradict the inherent right of individual and collective self-defense. So we would be operating under the inherent right recognized right in the UN Charter.
So you believe the possibility that they could enrich to react to bomb grade represents a sufficient threat that we can invoke self-defense with a preemptive strike?
You need to read the latest IAEA report. All public information that the IAEA has on Iranian worked with shaped charges of high explosives clearly intended for a weaponization capability. There's very little doubt what they're aiming toward.
Okay. Former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton. He's working with the American Enterprise Institute, AIE.org, by the way, if you want to check out.
AEI.org.
AEI, thank you very much. AEI.org. Check out his writings. He's a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Ambassador, thanks so much for dropping by.
Thank you.
27 minutes past the hour. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Your call's up next.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
I think our dream is coming back here. 223 days, 11 hours, 15 minutes, 32 seconds until George Bush voluntarily leaves office. Well, my friends, there you heard it right from the horse's mouth, as they say. Nothing personal intended. John Bolton, one of the lead neocon defenders of our policy in Iraq. I believe he was one of the signatories of the Project for New American Century. Certainly an advocate for our invading Iraq, now claiming that if we bomb Iran, it would not be a war crime. And that time is running out and negotiation won't work any longer. Now, debating him on this point, on these points, obviously is going to do no good, but I wanted you to hear from the people close to the administration, from the people who have historically sat down with George Bush and said, this is what you should do, sir, what their thoughts are on this issue. This is really serious stuff now. In the Associated Press, I believe, well, let's see here. Yeah, I know this is a Reuters story. Just this morning. The headline, Iran warns of painful response if Israel attacks. Iran's defense minister was quoted on Tuesday as warning Israel of a very painful response if it launched a military strike over the Islamic Republic's disputed nuclear program. This is because on Friday, Israeli Transport Minister Shaul Mofaz told an Israeli newspaper an attack on Iran, quote, looked unavoidable, end quote. This is what the Israeli Transport Minister said. Given the apparent failure of UN sanctions to deny Tehran technology with bomb-making potentials, he said, Iran daily quoted Iranian Defense Minister Najjar as saying, quote, our armed forces are at the height of their readiness, and if anyone should want to undertake such a foolish job, the response would be very painful. And many folks think that, you know, this has a lot to do with why oil is hitting $139 a barrel. I mean, this is serious stuff. CallCongress.org. You want a reason for impeachment? And again, by the way, kudos to Dennis Kucinich. And let me say, earlier I said, you know, impeachment isn't good enough for Bush. There needs to be prosecution. And frankly, I'd say for the whole bunch of them. But beyond that, impeachment doesn't rule out prosecution. It's just not going to happen, unfortunately. But nonetheless, callcongress.org, support Dennis Kucinich's resolution for impeachment, and perhaps equally important, I mean, if impeachment is the way to stop it, but it, you know, as I said, I don't think it's going to happen, but equally important, prepare for a strong U.S. response, again, for a strong congressional response against the Bush administration if they do or if they participate with any other country, and in this case it appears it's Israel, in attacking Iran. Particularly now that Iran has said, we will allow an international consortium to enrich the uranium on our land, and y'all can watch what's going on. I mean, here's a serious effort at diplomacy that's being blown off, apparently, by this administration, at least based on what I just heard from Mr. Bolton. I certainly think it's being blown off. So, anyhow, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Ken in San Pedro, California. Hey, Ken.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I am one of your biggest fans. Anyway, I guess you hit right on it right there, what you just said, the blowing off of this issue. And I guess I want to exhort, maybe it's an exhortation, encouragement, when interviewing these people, it's your show. And he's coming on there, you know, and you say, well, isn't it a war crime if we attack Iran? He said, that's ridiculous. You know,
right.
I mean,
I honestly wanted to know his response to that answer. I don't think that, you know, shoving his face in the fact that I disagree with him, you know, I mean, there are people who will come on and debate me for the purpose of debate. But by and large, administration officials and former officials are not going to come on and debate a talk show host. They're going to offer their opinion. And I actually want to hear this guy's opinion because I think he reflects the thinking of many people in the administration. So, you know, trashing him on the air simply means that he'll never come back. And, we know what's going on here. I don't have to win an argument with John Bolton, and I'm certainly not going to change his mind.
I guess what I'd like to somehow, I don't exactly know how it could be done, but somehow let him go away knowing that he coming back with something like, with all due respect, you're just dead wrong.
I guarantee you, Ken, he knows my position on these issues. Ken, I appreciate the call. Dan in Newfane, Vermont. Dan, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. You know, I agree with everything you said about impeachment so far, but there are two big points I think you're missing a little bit.
Okay.
The first one is impeachment, while it has to do with the president and the vice president, it's a remedy for the Constitution.
I agree.
It's a Constitution that's been damaged, and we need impeachment even if it started on January 10th.
I agree.
We needed to start to say we are actually interested in being a constitutional republic.
I agree. The Constitution mandates impeachment.
And then the other very important point is Congress can complain about attacking Iran. They can complain all they want to, and this administration stonewalls. The only kind of investigation that the administration cannot claim executive privilege for is an impeachment investigation.
That's right. That's right. Because of the U.S. versus Nixon. And absolutely. And another good reason to start impeachment. So as I said, go to callcongress.org. It's a website. It's on our website. We've listed all the 800 numbers that we can find that will allow you to call Congress free. And you call, you get into the Capitol Hill switchboard, and if you don't know who your senators, each one of us, unless you live in the District of Columbia, each one of us has two senators and one member of the House of Representatives. Give them your zip code. They can tell you who it is or who they are. And call each one of them and just say, hey, would you please connect me to so-and-so? Would you please connect me to so-and-so? And let them know. Impeachment, let's start impeachment now. And we want to do anything we can to stop an attack on Iran. Mark in Fort Lauderdale. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Tom. I've listened to your show a lot. I know most of your positions that you've come out on different things, especially attacking Iran because of their nuclear weapons capability. It's very interesting here. You had a guest on the show is obviously very, very educated on the issues. And to tell you the truth, Tom, you got no game. You come up hard and heavy on callers that you don't mind hanging up on, and then you hang up on them, and then you shoot off your mouth. But when you got somebody on the phone...
Okay, thanks a lot, Mark. Andrew in Haywood, California. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
I'm fine.
yeah, basically, I sat through all 3 hours of Dennis Kucinich talking about laying out every...
Yeah, he laid out a list of 35 of these crimes that this administration is...
Yeah, I'm just wondering, why hasn't the media, the general media, you've covered it, but that's right. About it. The general media has not even looked at it.
Yeah, the reason that the general media has not covered it is because it didn't come out of the Judiciary Committee, which means it's not a serious attempt at impeachment, a legally serious attempt at impeachment. It has to come out of the Judiciary Committee, number one. And number two, because it was just Dennis Kucinich. If Dennis had managed to get 50 or 60 co-sponsors or 40 or 50 other members of the House of Representatives to stand with him as he spoke, if he could demonstrate that there was any kind of movement in the House of Representatives in this direction, if he had 100 people who would hold a joint press conference with him afterwards, then this would be huge news. It would be all over the place. And you know, this is the ability to bring people together is one of those, you know, presidential qualities, as it were, that I think is so important. And I don't know if it's Dennis or the topic. I frankly suspect it's the topic and it's not Dennis Kucinich, because, you know, he's a good guy and I agree with him on virtually all his policies. But, you know, it would have been, unfortunately, it would have been so much more effective if he could have gotten a consensus or if he could have gotten a bunch of people together on this. And I just, you know, we need to be encouraging. You need, Andrew, to be encouraging your member of the House of Representatives. I've already called mine to support Dennis Kucinich in doing this. But, you know, it should have happened before. I mean, it's going to, the media is perceiving this, since it was just Dennis Kucinich, as one guy grandstanding. And that's why it's not getting covered. So anyway, we need to be addressing that. Joe in Denver. Hey, Joe.
Hi, Tom. I just want to address the absolutely maddening hypocrisy of the United States' position regarding the Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Right.
George Bush withdrew from the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty as one of the first things that his administration accomplished.
Right.
And that was really the cornerstone of all non-proliferation efforts.
Right.
The way that other countries would remedy our withdrawal and building of a anti-ballistic missile system is simply to build a hell of a lot more missiles to overwhelm it, and
That's
Russia
right.
has done this.
That's right. And then we've got countries like
Israel
India
was,
who...
in violation of the non-proliferation treaty when they attacked Syria.
Well, and you've got countries like India who never signed the nuclear non-proliferation agreement, who then went ahead and built a nuclear weapon. And Bush's response to that is to say, oh, here, we'll give you more nuclear power. We'll give you some faster, fancier reactors. You don't even have to take down those old ones that can be used to make weapons-grade plutonium. I mean, it is just plain old flat-out nuts. You're absolutely spot on, Joe. This is the policies of this administration have been insane from the get-go. And we are reaping the consequences of that, and it's not a pretty thing. It's not just harming the Constitution, not just harming the planet, not just harming future generations. I mean, they are trashing the Constitution on which this country was founded. The foundational elements, the foundational concepts that created the United States of America are being trashed by the Bush administration. We have to stop that. 45 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, there's people and more people. What do they know? No, no. Go to work in the summer high rise and vacation down at the Gulf of Mexico. Oh, yeah. And there's winners and there's losers. But that ain't no big deal.
9 and a half minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Ellen Ratter with the Talk Radio News Service. Our update on the news of the day from talkradionews.com. What's going on around the world? Ellen, I see that the Republicans have shot down the windfall profit tax and that the that Bush...
51 to 43.
51 to 43. Interesting. Now, 51. So they got a couple of Democrats to cross over.
Well, I thought, let's see.
Oh, you mean they only had 51 votes and they couldn't cut off debate.
That's right.
I see. So the Republicans filibustered this.
Yes, that's what we would say in the business.
Yeah. Yeah. Why didn't Harry Reid say to them, "Okay, if you guys want to filibuster this, get ready to stand up there and talk for the next 24 hours?"
I don't know. You're going to have to ask Harry Reid.
Yeah.
Maybe he didn't want to give him that much time on C-SPAN.
No, I don't think so. I think, well, who knows? I mean,
I think the Democrats really did want this to go through. I think that this was not just a
Well, what would Bill Frist have done if he was Senate Majority Leader and he wasn't getting his way on something that was important to him? He would have said, "Okay, guys, filibuster."
Well, I think that actually either you or I should call up his press secretary, Jim Manley, and find out.
Yeah. Okay, we'll put it on.
Because I'm sure they have their reasons. And, I mean, I don't think Harry Reid, although you and I disagree about him, I think he's a lot of tougher bird than you think he is.
I'm just looking at this one particular issue, Ellen. I know in some areas he's done, you know, very, very good, and a lot of the senators have a lot of respect for him. But I agree with Bernie Sanders that, you know, we have seen more Republican filibusters in this session, this Congress, than in any since the founding of this country. And he has, and the average American doesn't know that. And, you know, back in the day when the Democrats forced the Republicans to actually demonstrate that they were trying to shut down government, it blew up in their face.
Yes, it did.
And you know, all Harry Reid would have to say is, instead of saying, "Oh, you're going to filibuster us? Okay, we'll just stop and we'll go on to the next thing."
Let me just go to a different picture of all of this.
Sure.
And that is, if the goal is status quo, don't make too many rocks, don't look like we're being obstructionist until we win the election in November, then that's a good strategy. If that's not their goal, I don't think it is.
But he would be portraying the Republicans as obstructionists if he let them filibuster, if he forced them to filibuster.
And I understand that, but I think if I'm going to read this Congress correctly or the Senate correctly, my guess is they want to see they want to portray the Democrats as not really trying to put their nose to the ground, so to speak.
You mean the Republicans
until they
want
win
to.
The election?
I mean, Trent Lott.
I think you're going to see a mean, mean Democratic Senate.
Yeah, after the election, I suspect so. But here's the problem. I mean, Trent Lott started out with, you know, he was unashamed of this. I don't think he said it publicly. He said it in the Republican caucus, but it was reported on, and he confirmed it. He said, "We're going to block any meaningful attempts to pass legislation by Democrats in the Senate by filibuster. And then we're going to run in 2008. He said this a year and a half ago. And then we're going to run in 2008 on the campaign platform of a do-nothing Democratic Senate Congress.
Right.
And that's exactly what he's doing. And the one guy who could have stopped that is Harry Reid. And he didn't.
Well, I've seen Harry Reid operate, and I don't know his reasons, but and I know Bernie Sanders disagrees with me on this one, but I think there's a larger plan here.
Okay.
I'm not sure what it is, but I just do.
If you find out what it is, would you let us know?
I will. I'll try to find out behind the scenes.
Great.
Meanwhile, let's go on to President Bush and what he is saying in the European Union. It's kind of interesting because the EU actually came out with a statement on verifiable issues with the IAEA in Iran.
Right.
And also a full and open trade. Well, of course, Bush wanted some kind of statement on Iran, and he did get it. But then today in his press briefing, he talked about the issues of Iran trade and climate change. Some of the things that he said were really quite eye-popping. He said he talked about nuclear installations in Iran, which we don't really know whether they're there or not. My guess is they're probably not, but hey, that was right. What I guessed with Iraq, and I was right, but I'm not going to the 100% with that. But then he said, if you were living in Israel, you'd be nervous too. And then in terms of trade, he said that trade is the one thing that he said, if you are worried about global development, then trade is the best way to help poor people. Well, how about...
Hasn't worked out for Mexico.
Right.
I mean, since NAFTA, poverty in Mexico has exploded, and poverty in the United States has exploded. It hasn't worked out for anybody. I mean, it's worked out for some large multinational corporations. Let me take this back to Iran in the minute that we have left here, Ellen. We just had John Bolton on this program telling us that the clock has run out, that there's very few. He went through the obligatory speech about how dropping bombs on Iran must be the last resort. I said, wouldn't that be a war crime? There's no authorization for it. He said, no, the U.N. authorizes self-defense. I said, you're suggesting that simply thinking that Iran might have the ability to enrich uranium to weapons grade is enough to invoke self-defense on our part? And he essentially said yes. It sounds to me like the people in the Cheney circle, who still control a lot of power in this Bush White House, are pushing really hard for U.S. strike on Iran really soon.
Oh, I think they're pushing very, very hard. And there is some sort of chatter on some of the blog sites on the Internet to that. And I think that, as one sort of neocon told me, you don't think Bush wants to have it on his historical record that somehow Iran developed a nuclear bomb on his watch?
Well, the North Koreans did. I mean, it's like he might as well have a twofer. Amazing. Well, thank you, Ellen. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Great talking with you, Ellen.
Thank you.
And it was great seeing you this last weekend. Coming up next, David Sirota.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Truth in Broadcasting.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. All across the country, we are seeing, and I mean, literally we are seeing, and I shared with you, I think it was earlier in the week, maybe it was, perhaps it was last week, David Sirota's most recent piece on this, not just the uprising that he writes about in his book, The Uprising, an unauthorized tour of the populist revolt scaring Wall Street and Washington. And you can learn all about that over at davidsirota.com. But also a significant shift in the perception of Americans of big business versus, you know, government as a positive force versus a negative force. David Sirota, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Great to have you here with us. Your writings are just absolutely great and spectacular. And this book is fascinating. You traveled the country from Albany to Seattle, infiltrated a Minuteman group. In particular, I thought that your conversation with Lou Dobbs was one that was sort of emblematic of the situation. You talk about him you talked about, first of all, how he told Wolf Blitzer, we're not going to have any Anna Nicole Smith stories. And then it kind of goes downhill or uphill, depending, I suppose, on your perspective from there. Tell us about this.
Yeah, well, Lou Dobbs straddles the populist divide, meaning the how there's right-wing populism in this country and a left-wing populism, and you know, you watch Lou Dobbs and you listen to him talk about the war on the middle class and corporate power and unfair trade, and if you're a progressive, you say, I'm with you, Lou. And then he goes and talks about immigration, and you're like, I'm not with you, Lou. You're off the deep end. And right. what the conversation I had with him in part was about was how and why he separates those issues and how I think calculated that is, right? He separates the issue of free trade from the issue of immigration. He talks about free trade, and then he moves into talking about immigration, and never the twain shall meet. Right. And I think that's deliberate, because if you don't connect them, you're making a purely anger argument. If you do connect them, and of course they are connected, then you're making a more holistic argument about the system. I mean, obviously, when you have a NAFTA that opens up Mexico to subsidized agribusiness like ADM that then wipes out Mexico's farming economy, you're going to have an immigration problem. But Lou Dobbs doesn't really want to talk much about that, because he wants to basically demagogue the issue of trade and then demagogue the issue of immigration and tap into that anger.
He's got his world famous syllogism, which is fairly easy to deconstruct, which all basically boils back down to offense, you know, and which not only will destroy species, but won't work.
Well, I was on his radio show a couple days ago, and I said, Lou, you know, if we did what you want to do, and we build a 10-foot or a 20-foot wall, all we're doing is creating a market for 11-foot or 21-foot ladders. If we don't actually address the entire problem in a real way,
right,
then it's not going to solve anything.
Right. Yeah, is the bottom line. The Minutemen, the rise of the Minutemen. I remember when I was a kid, this was a right-wing fringe group. Well, tell us about the Minutemen.
Yeah, the Minutemen, I spent some time at the California-Mexican border with them, and I asked the question of what makes somebody leave their house, a politically, you know, I guess, disinterested person, get up, leave their house, and drive down to the border to pretend that they're guarding the border. And I asked that question, and what I found was that, sure, it's some racism. I think it's some xenophobia, fear of the other, but it's a lot of fear. There's a lot of fear out in this country. When you turn on the television, you hear that terrorists are coming into our country, and there's everything to be afraid of. You know, the conservative response, or one of the conservative responses, has been to drive down to the border. And one of the most interesting things that somebody said to me, one of the Minutemen said to me down there, was, look, I was watching Fox News, I was watching Sean Hannity, and I just decided that, you know, I got to get off my butt and do something. I've got to go do something.
Yeah.
So driving down to that border, I think, is a way, a conservative response, and a way for conservatives to feel like they're engaged in some way.
Well, that's what Americans want to do. Americans want to be engaged. They want to feel like they're part of the solution rather than part of the problem, you know, to use the old cliche. And conservatives and progressives right across the board, you know, Americans, we're a very involved people. I don't think we're necessarily unique in that, but it's really part of our founding mythology and the ethos of this country. You write in one of the later chapters about, you know, driving along with, I forget the woman's name, and she's pointing out, you're talking about Rex Tillerson, and she points out the ExxonMobil headquarters, the uprising against corporate America.
Right. I traveled. I snuck into the ExxonMobil shareholder meeting in 2007 with a group of shareholder activists who were pushing a shareholder resolution to get the company to address global warming. ExxonMobil is a company whose products have created 5% of all human generated carbon emissions since 1880. And it's incredible. And what I found was that this is the shareholder activism and shareholder democracy uprising is a corner of the larger uprising that very few people have paid attention to, but offers an enormous amount of power, enormous amount of ability to organize around, and to the point where when they offered up their resolution at that meeting, Rex Tillerson looked very, very nervous and was forced to acknowledge that global warming is now a problem. Now, you may say to me, look, what does that matter? ExxonMobil's still doing what it's doing. But look, if you can get a company that's been responsible for 5% of all carbon emissions, human-generated carbon emissions, to actually even change a teeny little bit, you've made a planet-wide impact.
Right, right. Excuse me. What you write about how Americans in the 30s. In the 20s, they were trusting big business, or excuse me, prior to that, they were trusting big business. Then, you know, big business crashed the country, you know, with the Great Depression. We as Americans began to trust government again during the Roosevelt administration. Reagan came in and said, no, don't trust government. And the public opinion polls were showing that we began to trust big business again. And now it's changed again. Am I getting the arc of this right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The late 1970s, you look at Gallup's poll about confidence in different institutions in the country. And what you see is that there was that post-Watergate disaffection with government stoked by Ronald Reagan. But there was a confidence in big business, the banks, the financial system. What's changed today is on that same Gallup poll, there's a similar level of dissatisfaction with the direction of the government, confidence in the government. And I think that's based on the post-Abramoff era. But what's changed is you now have this real severe loss of confidence in big business and the economic system as a whole. And I think that's why, although this uprising, I think, could go into a right or left direction, I think it's more likely to go in a progressive direction because progressives have been making this critique of our economic system for years. Conservatives have spent the last generation making themselves synonymous with those economic institutions.
So define the uprising in a nutshell.
It's that middle state between total disengaged chaos and a full-fledged or a number of full-fledged social movements. It is a moment of opportunity, an upsurge in anger, an upsurge for an opportunity for a full-fledged social movement to come about.
And at what times in the past have we seen this in the United States?
I would say three times in the last century. Right, you had an uprising election or an uprising moment in 1932, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. an uprising moment in 1964, and an mm-hmm. uprising moment in 1980. In 32 was a reaction to the Great Depression, brought about the New Deal, the labor laws, et cetera, et cetera. 64, right in the middle of the ferment of the civil rights movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement was starting. That brought about a historic landslide election, the Great Society, war on poverty, and ultimately an end to the Vietnam War. And then in the late 70s, you had, and I think it's most analogous to right now, you had an energy crisis, a Middle East crisis, a recessionary crisis, a crisis in confidence in government, and the conservatives took that uprising and channeled it into, and it created the full-fledged conservative movement that we're now living under.
Well, to the extent to which they're trying to, in the last half minute we have here, David Sirota, the extent to which they're trying to pick our pockets and scare us at the same time, I mean, it worked in 2000, it seemed to work in 2004, it's not going to work again?
I don't think so. I don't think it's going to work again. I think that everything tells us that we have a chance to take this uprising and make it our own, we progressives. But the responsibility is for us.
And how do we do that, real quickly?
Well, I think that what we have to do is not focus all of our attention only on presidential politics. Mm-hmm. And when we do focus our attention on presidential politics, we have to remember that the election is a starting point, not an ending point. As you probably saw in the news today, Barack Obama put an advisor who defended Walmart as his top economic advisor. We have to put the pressure on.
Right. So from the grassroots up. And at the local level, at the national level, right across the board, we have to get active and get involved.
Exactly.
David Sirota, his new book, The Uprising, an unauthorized tour of the populist revolt, scaring Wall Street and Washington, davidsirota.com. Thanks, David.
Thanks, Tom.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People.
Cost is, you know, getting it ain't hard. You sign along the dotted line, you can take it home today. Buddy, let me tell you, you're gonna pay and pay and pay, old MasterCard.
You mastered me.
I'll still be.
And welcome back, 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman Radio Program. My old friend Dr. Louis Belmadrona is with us. He is, you have an MD, a PhD, you're a professor of psychiatry and medicine. The author of the Coyote Healing Trilogy, Coyote Wisdom, Coyote Healing, and now your new book, Narrative Medicine,
right.
Lewis. And the website, healing-arts.org, mm-hmm. your website. Mm-hmm. And welcome.
Thank you.
Great to have you in the studio with us.
Thanks.
Great to have you visiting Portland.
Yes.
It's always great to see you. You are practicing medicine in Canada. You've used to teach medicine down at the University of Arizona, wasn't it?
Right, Arizona.
Along with Andrew Weil in the, mm-hmm. in the integrative medicine program. You used to practice out on the East Coast.
New York City.
What was the hospital?
Beth Israel.
Yeah, and you were practicing medicine there. And that wasn't psychiatry. That was emergency medicine.
Family medicine.
So, I mean, you've been all over the map. You've seen everything. And now you're in Canada practicing medicine and also a professor of psychiatry at University in
University of Saskatchewan.
Great. So, here in the United States, we have 50 million people who are uninsured, but probably another 40 million or so who are underinsured. Bankruptcy, 51%, you've cited the
right.
statistic earlier,
right.
we use it a lot. 51% of all bankruptcies in America are the consequence of people getting sick. How many people go bankrupt in Canada, where you're now practicing medicine and teaching medicine? How many?
Zero. 0%. No one
zero.
Does. And they can't fathom this statistic from America. They just can't compute it. It doesn't make. They don't believe me when I tell them this.
Really?
Really?
Canadians?
No.
You tell them how bad it is here, and they go, "No, it's not
they
possible."
They say it can't be possible.
There'd be an uprising.
Right. Exactly.
That's incredible.
I just can't believe it.
The you know the right wing is out there saying, "Look at what great care Teddy Kennedy got." You know, he got wonderful care, instant, you know, the best, you know, and certainly, yeah, he got to fly in a private jet to the hospital. He's got a pile of money. But, you know, anywhere in the world, I mean, in some third world country, somebody with a pile of money like Teddy Kennedy can get good medical care. The question is, what about the rest of us?
Well, that's a good question, because the rest of us in the U.S. mostly are uninsured. You know, if you have Medicare, you still have to pay an $820 deductible for each hospitalization.
Wow.
And most things come with a 20% deductible at minimum, except for mental health care, which is a 50% deductible.
So even our single-payer health care system in the United States, because it doesn't cover everybody, and so there's not a huge political force to make it to fix it.
Right. And I don't understand why AARP doesn't fight back more.
Well, because they make so much money on insurance. AARP is principally in the business of selling insurance.
Well, there you go.
Therefore, the donut hole and all that kind of thing.
Right.
It's absolutely incredible. Lewis, you're also Native American, I should have mentioned, and your book, Coyote Healing, and now Narrative Medicine, much of this has to do with the arc of how healing happens in different cultures and bringing some of the perspective of older cultures to this younger culture of the invaders to this continent.
Well, and the take-home message is that we can do a lot to help ourselves outside of technology.
Uh-huh.
That so much of why we're sick and probably why the healthcare system is broke is that we rely on technology to cure things that really lifestyle should be the best approach.
And by lifestyle, not just eating well and exercising, but
lowering stress, having fun, taking vacations, which Americans don't do. Canadians right. take 6 weeks vacation a year.
They do?
Yes.
Is it mandated by the government, or is it just normal?
Everyone gets it. It's normal. And they all go to Thailand and Australia and New Zealand. They go, they take holiday. And it's amazing. You know what's so amazing in Canada? At the clinic where I work, at 4:45, there's not a soul in sight. Nobody in sight.
At the end of the day?
At the end of the day. Everyone is gone.
Why?
Because it's an 8:30 to 4:45 kind of job. That's what healthcare is in Canada.
So what happens if somebody gets sick?
Well, we have someone on call. I mean, it's, you know, the hospital emergency room is there. We have someone on call 24/7.
Right.
So they get taken care of.
But the people who type up the forms and do the paperwork and everything, it's a 9-to-5 job, basically.
And the doctors.
But they're not paid as much. You can't become
Wrong.
A millionaire as a
Wrong.
Doctor in Canada.
You get paid more in Canada to be a primary care physician or a psychiatrist than you do in the U.S.
Really?
Yes.
Now, is that not because of the exchange rate, not because
no.
the Canadian dollar is so much
No,
stronger.
Because you just get paid more.
That's incredible.
You get paid less to be a cardiac surgeon.
Uh-huh.
So apparently primary care is valued more there.
I'm astounded. I'm absolutely astounded. This completely contradicts all the right-wing stories we're hearing here in the United States.
Well, the right-wing loves to tell stories.
Why? Yeah, but how do they get away with it? I mean, you know, I lived in Vermont. In fact, you and I both lived in Vermont.
Right.
I never saw a Canadian coming to Vermont looking for health care. I saw every Saturday or Sunday morning in Montpelier the bus that Bernie Sanders would organize with seniors getting in it, going up to Canada to buy medication.
Right.
Do you see Americans showing up in Canada looking for health care?
No, but then I'm about 500 kilometers north of the border.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
So you're way up there.
I'm way up there. Saskatoon, Saskatchewan.
Yeah.
Minus 51 in the winter.
So we have in the United States a single-payer health care system, Medicare. We have a socialized medical system, the Veterans Administration. You've seen the Canadian system, you've worked in the Canadian system, you're working in the American system.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
I walk the line. I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine. I walk
34 minutes past the hour. Boy, we've covered a lot of territory today. By the way, just a quick reminder again, this great movie about the situation with regard to oil, Crude Impact. It's on the Sundance Channel tonight at 9:35 Eastern Time, Friday the 13th. It'll be on at 10:35 a.m. Eastern Time, and June 15th, Sunday. I had this wrong earlier. On Sunday, it'll be on at 3:35 p.m. Eastern Time, all on the Sundance Channel. Check it out. Crude Impact is the name of the movie. Our program brought to you, by the way, in part by the Teamsters working against the Columbia trade deal, is this crazed thing. You can read all about that and get more information on that over at teamster.org. 35 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. John in Trumansburg, New York. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to make a point of clarification and perhaps maybe a gentle criticism of the way that you handled John Bolton's last comment.
Okay. Well, you can send me a note, John. I'm just not going to go there. Jack in Los Angeles. Hey, Jack.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
And thanks for not telling me how to run a talk show. Appreciate that.
No, I know what you've got going there.
Yeah,
in reference to Representative Kucinich's action last night, his brave action, commendable.
Yes.
It will probably go nowhere. And I think in order to get some leverage. I think people, I don't know what the mechanism should be, but I think there should be people in the Congress willing to bring charges against Speaker Pelosi to remove her as Speaker for aiding and abetting war crimes and crimes against humanity by not going through with impeachment.
You know, here's the problem that she has. Again, you know, we've talked about this before. She has a 36 vote majority in the House of Representatives. It might be 38, but it's under 40. More than 40 members, Democratic members of the House of Representatives, are from Republican districts, and they will lose those seats if they take anything other than relatively moderate to conservative positions, certainly on something like impeachment. So the Democrats could lose the House of Representatives because of that razor-slim majority that she has if she takes on impeachment. At least this is my understanding of the political calculus, as I've had explained to me now by at least three Democratic members of the House of Representatives. What does she do if that's the reality? I mean, it seems to me like the only thing that we can do is we can get – she has to have, or whoever the speaker is next time around, if it's not Nancy Pelosi, has to have a majority, a more progressive majority in the House of Representatives rather than just that, you know, I mean, there's more than 40 in the Blue Dog delegation, although I wouldn't characterize all of them as, you know, obstructionists or conservatives or anything. I mean, there's some good people in there as well. But the point is that she doesn't have a real progressive majority. She doesn't even really have a Democratic majority in the House of Representatives. What are you going to do?
Well, I think the masses of people that have been coming out for Obama from center and center Republicans and independents are showing that I think we've got more pull than the people in Washington realize.
Yeah, I agree with you, Jack.
Say again?
I agree with you.
And also, I'm really afraid that very soon they're going to launch that strike on Iran, and this would be the only thing that would upset their timetable.
Yeah. Yeah.
Also, I'm afraid that July 3rd, which is a new moon, might be their date.
It's not inconceivable. Jack, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. This whole issue with Nancy Pelosi is one that I've really struggled with, because on the one hand, John Conyers has essentially made it clear that he would move forward, but the leadership is holding him back, or has implied that, I think. I would love to see her get behind impeachment even now, even, you know, 4 days before Bush leaves office. I'd love to see her get behind that. And yet I hear the other side from Democrats who I respect. And I don't think it's just wimping out. I think that there's a political reality here. But on the other hand, I think if enough of us speak out, maybe we can change that political reality. Certainly we'll do it at the ballot box. Richard in Santa Fe listening on KTRC. Hey, Richard.
Hi. I wanted to call and comment. You had a guest on from Saskatchewan.
Yeah, Louis Melmadrona, Dr. Louis Melmadrona.
Okay, and I lived in Canada from 1977 till 92.
Mm-hmm.
And, she said that people up there take 6 weeks holiday. That's just not true. There are people that do. They have certain jobs that are, but most people don't. And, I just wanted to put in a little bit of realism that, you know, and I'm very supportive of what Canada does, very progressive, but they do take their pound of flesh.
Yeah. All in all, would you rather have their health care system or ours?
Oh, by all means.
Okay.
But, you know,
yeah.
6 weeks holiday, that's just, it's, you know.
Okay,
I'm sure,
so in other words, Canada is not the paradise that,
right.
Yeah. Okay.
They have problems. Taxes are, you know, ginormous, but trust me, I'd rather trade their healthcare system than ours.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, great. Richard, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Prez in Santa Rosa, California. Hey, Prez, how you doing?
Hey, Tom. How are you there, my friend?
Great.
Good. Listen, first I want to say thanks. I want to make a couple of comments, and I'll use the utmost celerity, because I'd love to hear you riff on things. I have a solution for the Blue Dog problem. Here's what it is. And God,
it's not really a Blue Dog problem.
I understand.
Not, you know, it's more.
But
of
the gist of that argument, anyway, mm-hmm. I understand it's not really that. It's the fact there's no support. Remember what happened in Watergate. Oh, God, we need Sam Ervin. When the charges were laid out, when the thing started, the investigation was out there for everyone to see. Republicans are the ones that went and told Nixon it's over.
Yeah, but that was after the evidence came out. And
no, I know,
the thing that
see,
led the charge, Prez, was the press. The corporate press in America during Watergate was willing to call out the president because they weren't afraid of him and they weren't in bed with him. The corporate press right now is both afraid of the Bush administration, at least the movie stars who call themselves news people are afraid, or the TV stars are afraid of the Bush administration. They're afraid of losing access. And the networks themselves have interlocking boards of directors with the companies that are contributing the money that's keeping the Republican Party alive and keeping Bush and Cheney and all their buddies in office.
I understand that, sir. But I would still say that once the investigation starts, is allowed to start by the mere mechanism, the very beginning mechanism, they would have to cover
it. But it's already started. And look at what happened. They
not formally, it has.
No, it certainly has. They subpoenaed Harriet Bolton or Harriet Myers and Josh Bolton, and that's the track that would have taken you right to the White House. These were the two people who were counseling to and working with the Bush administration. They subpoenaed them before Congress, and they said, no, we're not going to show up. The administration is stonewalling Congress. The only choice, frankly, in my opinion, that Congress has right now is to use their inherent contempt authority. Well, and I don't think they know how to do it, from what I can see.
Yeah, they are kind of amateurish, aren't they?
Yeah, and this
that's one of the main reasons to keep Bush from pardoning people. But I still would argue with you, and the fact that I think that once they start the formal impeachment, just the investigation part of it, it will all have to come out, and they will have to turn into support.
No, you're not arguing with me, Press. I agree with you. I am absolutely in favor of articles of impeachment. Actually, I'm in favor of an impeachment, an investigation that is explicitly for the purposes of are there impeachable crimes. I'm totally in favor of that, and I encourage everybody to contact their member of Congress and say, you should have been standing there with Dennis Kucinich yesterday, and you should be telling Nancy Pelosi that you're gung-ho for it, too. Now, Prez, I got to move along, but I appreciate your call and comments, and I just want to be on the record. What I was saying earlier is that I have heard Pelosi's argument, and I don't have a strong counter-argument other than to say, we're going to activate so many people, Madam Speaker, that you're going to get it, that there is no risk to those Democrats who are representing the red districts, that there is no risk to them. And that's where we need to go with this thing, frankly, in my opinion. Howard in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Howard.
Yes, I was going to ask you your opinion, and I have my opinion. I'm going to give it to you, but your opinion of the number one priority for President Obama when he takes the inauguration in January.
I think it's the one that he is probably better suited for than anything else, by virtue of the fact that he was a professor at the University of Chicago, or whatever the university was, the law school there, professor of constitutional laws to restore our Constitution. And that means rolling back the unconstitutional laws and mandates and decrees and executive orders, and it means prosecuting the people who violated the Constitution over the last 8 years.
I think your opinion is greater than mine.
what was your opinion, number one priority?
My opinion is an executive order to replace gasoline as a fuel. I mean a crash program similar to Kennedy's putting us on the moon and Roosevelt building the atomic bomb, a crash program to replace gasoline as a fuel.
I think we're going to see that coming.
Infrastructure and the vehicles to burn hydrogen.
Yeah, I think hydrogen is basically a storage mechanism for solar or wind or wave or other forms of energy that need to be stored because they tend to go with the days. But yeah, Howard, spot on. That's going to happen. I'm telling you that is absolutely going to happen. You know, the fact that we're sending. To the Middle East, hundreds of millions of dollars every day it's crazy. That is going to happen. Anyhow, coming up tomorrow, Terry Jeffrey, editor of CNS News. We're going to discuss the issues of the day. And Rick Shuckelman, Associated Press, professor of history. We'll be right back.
Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
With a cardboard sign sitting there by the left turn line, flag on a wheelchair flapping in the breeze, one leg missing and both hands free. No one's paying much mind to him. The VA budget's just stretched so thin, and there's more coming back from the Mideast war. We can't make it here anymore.
9.5 minutes before the hour. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Joy in Santa Cruz. Hey, Joy.
Hi there.
Hey.
I'm also in your chat room.
I noticed. When I saw the message, I thought, okay, I'm going to put Joy up next. What's on your mind, Joy?
Well, I saw a diary today where John Conyers is basically asking people to refute or rebut his five top reasons for not impeaching. And evidently he met with Code Pink.
Oh,
and discussed this with them.
Where did you see this?
I saw it as a diary on Daily Kos.
Okay, I'll have to,
and
I
his five reasons
this morning.
Were the American people wouldn't want impeachment.
Right.
The corporate media will slay us.
Right.
There's not enough time, not enough votes, and it will cost us the election. Or the Democrats, he thinks.
Right. Right.
I would say to all five of those are reasons, it's the Constitution that we have to restore through impeachment. And that's what's important here. And their job is to protect that Constitution.
Yeah.
And there's another reason why impeachment is a very necessary thing to do for all these egregious crimes against our country. It's because the tool of impeachment needs to be restored to a legitimate purpose.
Yeah, I agree. It was used against Andrew Johnson illegitimately. It was used against Bill Clinton illegitimately. And it should be used legitimately. I absolutely agree with you. And well, and I, as you know, I am a supporter of impeachment. I just want to make that very clear.
Right, oh, I know you are.
And I always have been. That said, if there is no impeachment, I think, and frankly, I don't think that there's going to be, because no matter what we say, I mean, we need to, if there's an opportunity to speak back to John Conyers and say, no, we disagree, I mean, we should take it. But I think that the political calculus that's going
to
be done in Washington, D.C. is, okay, we're looking at a base here that might be 5% of the electorate, and we're looking at a corporate media that controls the ability, you know, the swing vote of probably 60% of the electorate, what kind of risk are we willing to take? And I frankly, that's, so my question to you, Joy, is let's just for a moment assume that Conyers actually might be right.
Okay.
And if he's right, and if instead of doing impeachment, what they do is they do a legislative agenda, they do investigations, they get all this information out in the press and out in the open, and then the Obama administration comes in, and then they begin to pursue prosecutions, doesn't that remedy the constitutional violations? Not quite as well. Clearly, we need to restore impeachment, I agree with you, to its legitimate place. But doesn't that begin the process of healing this country?
To a degree, but we still have – I think we can impeach these people even after they're out of office, actually. Legally, we can. But I think that we need to know what impeachment is for in this country.
Right.
And a lot of people don't know what it's for because they use it for such a trivial reason against Clinton.
Right.
And I think that your numbers might be wrong on how many people favor impeachment, too. 45%
It's over half. It's over half of Americans, you know, according to a Zogby poll that came out about 5-6 months ago, more than half of Americans said that they were in favor of investigations that might lead to the impeachment of the President of the United States.
That's
And that's not saying that they favored impeachment itself, but the investigations. And that's the information that needs to go to Conyers. Joy, I got to move along. I got a bunch of other callers, but thank you very much. Your points were really well made, and I appreciate the call, and great to see you in the chat room. Let's see here. Tom in Mesa, Arizona. Tom, you've been sitting on hold for quite a while there. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Sure.
I'm a fairly frequent listener, but I'm never a caller. And so, but today, when I heard your interview with Josh Bolton, John Bolton. I had to make a call.
Yeah.
I said, and this is the reason. I can't. This man's out of his frickin' mind.
I agree.
Attacking, this is ludicrous.
And the important thing, you know, the take-home message for all of us needs to be, this is the thinking inside the administration, because although he's not here, he wasn't here as a spokesman for the administration, he was here as a spokesman for the American Enterprise Institute. I'm telling you, they're all the same thing.
Yes, that's true. Now, the other point I wanted to make was, in 2006, Dick Cheney was interviewed. As a matter of fact, I heard the interview, I think, personally. And he was saying, you know, he was opposing, the Iranian energy program. And at that time, and as I know today, I don't think I'm wrong. I'm pretty sure I'm 100% on the money that they have not violated the IAEA regulations.
Actually, I had on Thursday, when I was doing the show from the United Nations, we interviewed the official spokesperson for the IAEA, and she said that Iran is in non-compliance right now on at least four different points.
On four points?
Yeah, four or five. I forget which it was.
Okay. Yeah. And
but see, what's happened is that the IAEA rules have been changed just for Iran by the Security Council, by a vote of the Security Council. And so Iran, you know, signed the Nuclear Nonproliferation Act, which gave them the right to produce nuclear power, you know, enrich uranium
right.
for nuclear power. Then the Security Council came in and said, okay, we know you signed this treaty. All these other countries signed this treaty. They can have reactors. But we're going to say you can't enrich your own uranium anymore. You're going to have to buy it from another state. And at that point, Iran said, nah, instead, what we will do, we're going to enrich uranium on our own soil. That's part of our national pride is associated with that. We will allow a group of other countries to participate with us in running the enrichment if you want, but it's going to happen on Iranian soil. And that's what has been, that's what the Iranians have on the table. That is, seems like a very rational thing. But just like, you know, Saddam Hussein, just before we started bombing Iraq, was saying, hey, you can look anywhere in the country you want. You can do anything right. You want. You know, Hans Blix was himself pointing it out. And, we took the irrational route. I suspect that I think it was very important that we all hear what he had to say, what Bolton had to say today, because it says this is what's coming next. Tom, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. We've got to wrap up the show here, though. And as I mentioned, tomorrow, Terry Jeffrey. Also, Rick Schenkman is going to be with us. He's an associate professor of history at George Mason University. The question, just how stupid are the voters of America? Is that even an appropriate word to use? Maybe. We'll have that conversation tomorrow. Thanks so much for being with us today. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Call your elected representatives and tell them, impeach, yes. Bomb Iran, no. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.
That's T-H-O-M Hartman with two N's, radio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.